From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 20th century classical music broke free from the sureties of Mozart and Beethoven and Bach, sometimes gently, as here with Sibelius, sometimes stridently, Stravinsky, atonally, Schoenberg, or minimalist to the point of pure sound, even silence, John Cage. Much of it was a challenge, like the era. Now, New Yorker music critic Alex Ross gives us the history of a century through its composers, its music. This hour On Point, a history of the 20th century in music. You can join the conversation from Stravinsky to John Cage. Can you hear the 20th century in the music of its composers? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Alex Ross. He's music critic for The New Yorker and author of the wonderful new book, The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. The multi-talented Icelandic singer Björk calls it an incredibly nourishing book that will rekindle anyone's fire for music. Alex Ross, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Very nice to be here.
I wish you, just to get a sense of the span of what you're writing about here, I wish you'd dive straight back. Take us to 1906, practically the dawn of the century. Richard Strauss is conducting his opera Salome, May 16th, 1906. You open the book with a wonderful description of all the history converging right there. Could you read a bit of that for us?
Sure. Well, it begins, when Richard Strauss conducted his opera Salome on May 16th, 1906 in the Austrian city of Graz, several crowned heads of European music gathered to witness the event. The premiere of Salome had taken place in Dresden 5 months earlier, and word had got out that Strauss had created something beyond the pale, an ultra-dissonant biblical spectacle based on a play by a British degenerate whose name was not mentioned in polite company, Oscar Wilde, that is, a work so frightful in its depiction of adolescent lust that imperial censors had banned it from the court opera in Vienna. Giacomo Puccini, the creator of La Bohème and Tosca, made a trip north to hear what terribly cacophonous thing his German rival had concocted. Gustav Mahler, the director of the Vienna Opera, attended with his wife, the beautiful and controversial Alma. The bold young composer Arnold Schoenberg arrived from Vienna with his brother-in-law Alexander Zemlinsky and no fewer than six of his pupils. One of them, Alban Berg, traveled with an older friend who later recalled the feverish impatience and boundless excitement that all felt as the evening approached. The widow of Johann Strauss II, composer of On the Beautiful Blue Danube, represented old Vienna. Ordinary music enthusiasts filled out the crowd. Young people from Vienna with only the vocal score as hand luggage, Richard Strauss noted in a letter to his wife. Among them may have been the 17-year-old Adolf Hitler, who had just seen Mahler conduct Richard Wagner's Tristan und Isolde in Vienna. Hitler later told Strauss's son that he had borrowed money from relatives to make the trip. There was even a fictional character present, Adrian Leverkühn, the hero of Thomas Mann's Dr. Faustus, the tale of a composer in league with the devil.
Alex Ross reading right from the top of his new book, The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. And I mean, so much is encapsulated just in that passage, Alex. You've got music that's beyond the pale, frightful cacophonous. You've got this amazing agglomeration of historical figures, Puccini and Mahler and Schoenberg and maybe even Hitler. And then, of course, you know in a hurry that you're not in Blue Danube country anymore, sitting right there.
Right.
Tell us what you're setting out to do in this book. We're going to hear a lot of music in this hour, but what's your goal in coming back with all this music on the table and the history woven straight through it?
Yeah, well, that was the idea, to give you the music itself and to give a sense of where it came from and how it hit the world, in a sense. And a lot of this music is confrontational, even shocking. Some of it is, on the other hand, very beautiful and very easy to listen to on first encounter. So an incredible variety of sounds, and I just try to go through them one by one and give you a little bit of the sense of the sound behind these phrases such as atonality and neoclassicism and 12-tone music that experts in the field bandy about, not always explaining what they mean, but then also the history and an incredible cast of characters. I think any novelist would salivate to have such a succession of bizarre personalities out of a Russian novel, the composers themselves, as well as the political situations that arose and And here at the beginning of the book is a glimpse of Hitler possibly lurking in the background of this glittering scene in Graz in 1906, gathering resentment in his mind or fueling ambitions that he could never fulfill artistically, but attempted to execute politically. Mm. And it goes on. You know, Hitler, of course, becomes a major character in the middle of the book. I have chapters devoted to music under the totalitarian regimes, and then on through the Cold War, where you find Aaron Copland in front of Senator McCarthy's committee and Stravinsky dining at the White House. So it keeps.
We'll hear that. There's so much here. That's not the last meeting of music and Hitler and ambition sitting there in 1906. Let's go straight to some of the sound that people found so shocking very early in the century. We're going to trace it right on through the century and get the history of that 100-year span as we do it. Here it is, 1913, Igor Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring. It caused riots. Okay, it's not Bach. Things get broken right away here. Riots in Paris when this came out. Alex Ross, it's fundamental. Everybody knows 20th century music was often challenging and difficult. So what's the case? What was going on here that moved us out of that kind of melodic tradition that people knew so well and into, let's say, Stravinsky?
Well, the composers, this new generation of composers that arose right at the turn of the century, they wanted to get beyond this very plush, lush world of Wagner and Brahms. They wanted to write a music with sharper edges that would have some of the same intensity as the modernist poetry that was being written at the same time, the great abstract painting. So instead of those sweet consonant chords, you do get dissonances and you get pounding rhythms and this primitivist energy. And, you know, on the one hand, it is difficult music at first encounter, and people did riot, and there was, you know, these famous incidents of people bashing each other over the head with their umbrellas at the premiere and so on, which is very fun to read about. Mm-hmm. But this music also had a certain popular energy. And after that initial riot, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring became a very well-loved piece by a lot of people. And I think it is those driving rhythms, and there is a kind of a prophecy of pop music to come here, as well as this modernist intensity and complexity.
Prophecy of pop music, perhaps, but also maybe even of war. And then we get the atonal piece that comes right in with those new rhythms. Schoenberg, 1909, 5 orchestral pieces. Here's a bit right here. And so we stretch our minds, we stretch our emotions. How was this received, Alex?
Well, even worse. There were real riots in Vienna when pieces such as this were first performed. Audiences were not so quick to fall in love with the music. And in fact, whenever Schoenberg's name appears on a program, even today, you'll find people muttering and sort of cursing at their programs, or perhaps not even showing up at all, knowing in advance that Schoenberg's going to be played. Because, you know, whereas Stravinsky, he has that infectious rhythm, and there is actually a lot of familiar melody swirling around, little bits and pieces of folk melodies. Now, Schoenberg just rejects the past completely. There are really no familiar chords here, nothing in the way of a conventional melody. Pure feeling, pure kind of expressionist energy, and this pre-war Viennese angst exploding to the surface.
But why that angst? Give us the history. We haven't had the disillusion of World War I here yet. What was driving Schoenberg into that angst?
Well, there are many, many pressures, I think, that were bearing down on him in this period. There was chaos in his personal life. His wife was actually having an affair with an expressionist painter, and he walked in on the two of them together.
There's angst.
The painter ended up committing suicide just as Schoenberg was making this drastic step into atonality. So there's that. There's the whole sense in Vienna of all of these artists in different fields confronting the comfortable bourgeois public with ugly realities. So this was very much in the air. And music in general at the turn of the century was tending toward more dissonance. There were a lot of composers heading in the same direction. Schoenberg was just the boldest of them and the most daring, and sort of won his place as the great revolutionary in 20th century music history.
A century starting off with dissonance and soon music put in the service of politics. Here's Dmitri Shostakovich, 1937. We'll talk about Shostakovich, Stalin, and all the rest. Alex Ross is with us. His new book is The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. You can join the conversation, have Sibelius and Schoenberg battled past Mozart and Beethoven onto your classical CD shelf, your iPod playlist. What do you hear in this century of music? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Alex Ross, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the 20th century's classical music, from Stravinsky and Mahler to Copland and Cage, and the history and world behind it. My guest is Alex Ross, music critic for The New Yorker, author of the really wonderful new book, The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. You can join the conversation. How do you respond to the atonal, abstract challenges of 20th century classical music? Why do we embrace the abstractions of Picasso and Jackson Pollock, but often run from the hall when Stravinsky, Schoenberg come on? Of course, it wasn't always tough. Here's Aaron Copland right behind us, a kind of the music of the people man. How do you look back on this century of music and its relation to the history of the 20th century? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And of course, behind us here, Aaron Copland, is 1944 Appalachian Spring, the Doppio Movimento here. And suddenly we're in this realm of peace, but, you know, we're rocketing through an hour here, Alex. By 1944, we've practically come through a war that had a lot of music behind us. You got a wonderful quote in here. At one point, you described earlier Hitler perhaps sitting and listening to Salome, in Graz in Austria, very early in the century. You quote Romain Rolland later saying, "There is too much music in Germany." Before we get to this sort of peaceful moment of Copland, what about that intersection of Germany and music and you know, Sturm und Drang here? How do you pack those together?
Well, it's a very chilling development when Hitler, a really committed music lover who knew quite a bit about the subject, or at least about Wagner and a couple of other his favorite composers, takes control of a country and blends his musical interests with his unholy and horrible political philosophy and uses these great composers of the 19th century as propaganda. And it's a very destructive development, which I think the consequences of we're still feeling today, because some of these great pieces still have very sinister associations for people, not only those who lived through the era, but those who've absorbed those associations secondhand. So that's something that in classical music we have to deal with, this taint, this contamination of Hitler's love for the music.
And not only certainly not only Hitler, who was stirred in unpredictable ways by the music. You quote Thomas Mann right at the beginning, again from Dr. Faustus, saying, "Despite the logical, moral rigor music may appear to display, it belongs to a world of spirits for whose absolute reliability in matters of human reason and dignity I would not exactly want to put my hand in the fire."
Yeah, well, that's the epigraph to the book, and these moral questions hang over some of these careers. The career of Richard Strauss, who took an official position in Nazi Germany and became embroiled in the politics of that era rather than leaving, emigrating, as Thomas Mann did. And Shostakovich, whose music we heard a little earlier, becoming entangled in Stalinist politics, and on the one hand being admonished by Stalin for straying too far from the easy popular style that he was asked to write in, but on the other hand, you know, having official titles and positions and enjoying a huge success as the symbol of Soviet music, a very ambiguous career. And Copland, who became entangled to some extent in the politics of the American Communist Party without actually joining it, but was one of many artists of the 1930s, 1940s, American artists who got into this tricky game of combining art and politics.
We'll look more closely at those politics, FDR, Copland, and all the rest. Let's take a call first, if we may, from Avon, Connecticut. Trig is on the line. Hi, Trig. You're on the air with Alex Ross.
Hi, thanks. You raised a question about, you raised something about abstract art being more readily embraced than newer music.
Yes, Alex Ross does himself. He says, look, we'll pay hundreds of millions for Jackson Pollock. People laud and praise Picasso, but still the hall thins out when you bring on, let's say, Schoenberg.
Well, I don't know if I completely agree with that. I think to a degree, yes, but there's a very big difference in the media as far as the experience. Music is a very immediate experience. You know, it completely relies on time for the experience.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't reflect the way you can with a painting. So you have to react immediately. On top of which, yeah, maybe there was more acceptance to the painting styles, but there is still, it wasn't embraced immediately. There was a lot of resistance. And even now, you talk to people who talk about paintings, and the cliche, I don't know much about art, but I know what I like. Well, that applies the same to music.
Certainly, right. Trig, you raise great questions all, and yet a lot of time has passed since Schoenberg, and we don't perhaps see the same popular embrace as we do of Pollock. But Trig raises, seems to me, the right questions here, Alex, and you get into it. I mean, these are obviously physically different medium, and physics may have a lot to do with the gap in how people responded, whether it was on canvas or on the eardrum.
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, sound has a physical effect on us. It enters our bodies. It's a shaking of the air. And so I think there is a big difference between how we experience a new piece of music and how we look at a painting. It's more visceral. It's more emotional. And there is also this aspect of pieces being played over a very strict span of time in front of a crowd, a captive audience stuck in the hall for the duration of a piece, unlike a viewer in the gallery who has the option of moving on to the next painting if he sees something not to his liking. It becomes a question of crowd psychology, and I think this is why we had those extreme reactions early on and why the music continues to cause trouble.
But maybe there's an arm's-length relationship with a painting, and Trig points to it, that
yeah.
We just don't have with music. It's so intimate that dissonance
right.
is simply psychologically
yeah.
harder to confront, take on board.
Yeah, in some contexts. Though in other contexts, it's completely familiar and natural. If you put that Schoenberg music on the soundtrack of your favorite action thriller or horror movie.
And it's done all the time, in effect,
yeah,
practically nearly.
Yeah, and no, you know, Hollywood film composer, you know, addressing a scene of anxiety, tension, you know, imminent mayhem,
right,
could possibly have done his job without Schoenberg having got there first and introduced all these chords. And also, you know, jazz. Some of these sharp dissonances appear all over jazz, but somehow they move through more fluidly through that music and don't cause the pang of anxiety that it does in the concert hall.
Let's go to Martha in Hingham, Massachusetts. Martha, you're on the air with Alex Ross.
Oh, yes. Hi, Tom. And,
hi.
Hello, Alex, and thank you for a sensational book. I'm at page 243.
Oh, good you.
Oh, thank you so much. That's a good page.
My way through. I'm a singer, and I sing with the Tanglewood Festival Chorus, John Oliver's group, and the Boston Symphony,
yeah,
and James Levine. And this book frames what last year was for us. We sang Moses and Aaron, the Schoenberg piece, and then saying John Adams' El Nino, which wraps up your book, actually. You're talking about meeting with him. But for me, I wish I'd had this book years ago, because it sort of it attaches personality to characters who are otherwise fairly formidable, even for people who are used to singing music. And I've just been overwhelmed by it. And also, I contacted the publisher because I wanted to find out if there's a way to hear some of the examples that you're describing in your book, and apparently you're doing that on your website.
Yes, I should say you can read an excerpt and also hear Alex's 20th Century Classical iMix on iTunes. Alex?
Yes. And I also have, if you go to my website, therestisnoise.com, I have a page called Audio Files over on the right-hand side, and you can go there, and there's actually 15 separate pages devoted to each chapter of the book, and many, many sound samples, usually quite brief, but you can get a taste for these different sounds. And, well, I'm so happy to hear all that, and that you're enjoying the book, obviously. And
it's great.
In fact, yesterday, coincidentally, I'd sent a note to other members of the chorus saying, this is just terrific, and in fact, we'll be singing Bolcom this year, or if that's how you pronounce his name.
William Bolcom, yeah.
Yeah, he's written a new symphony for the Boston Symphony that will be performed in the spring.
Martha, that's just great, and we love the thought of you informed as you sing it by what you're reading here. I should say, to make it simple also, you can just go to onpointradio.org, read an excerpt of the book, and get through to all the music and websites that Alex is talking about there. Martha, thanks very much for your call. Alex, I want to keep this history thread going. We heard that wonderful gloss on the Shaker hymn there from Aaron Copland, The Gift to Be Simple. And I mean, there you had politics. I mean, now we hear Copland, and it seems like it's everybody's This Is America advertisement or political ad. Then he was in the midst of extremely contemporary and contentious politics with that sort of fanfare for the common man approach to music.
Yeah, no, it's a delicious irony that this composer whose politics were quite radical, and he was Jewish and he was gay from Brooklyn, New York, and you know, over time his music has become, you know, the
and deeply
American
into
sound
communism,
and sort of, you know, forgetting about that a little bit. I mean, whenever you have a campaign commercial where you see, you know, farmers in fields and people sitting on their front porches in their rocking chairs and the newsboy going by throwing newspapers, it's
right,
absolutely guaranteed to be these kind of da-da-da-da-da kind of Copland-esque motifs in the background. So he's become a universal signifier, and this is a case of 20th century music, you know, absolutely entering the thick of the culture, and that's what really excites me as someone who loves music but also who loves history and these wonderful collisions and these ironic transformations.
We are plunging through history, and forgive me, but we've got a whole century on the table here.
Yep.
Let's listen for a minute, and there's a great story behind this one as well. Here's Olivier Messiaen, 1941, the quartet for The End of Time, The Eternity of Jesus. So beautiful, 1941, Messiaen. Of course, this is a French POW in a German prisoner of war camp composing, and his German guards got into it and brought him pens and paper and let him go off and do it. I mean, but the result, it's very 20th century in that context, but yet there's almost, a reference back to Bach here, a very religious man in a POW camp with a most serene, shockingly beautiful music here, Alex.
Well, very well put. I don't have too much to add to that. It is, you know, when people say that the 20th century was this time of dissonance and, composers going crazy and losing touch with their public, I usually say, go listen to the Quartet for the End of Time, this astonishingly beautiful music that's not speaking the language of the 18th or 19th century. It's a modern language, but it is so beautiful. And just the amazing idea of this man coming up with this music in the prisoner of war camp and it being first performed on a freezing cold night in January 1941 in an unheated hall with all of these prisoners of war from many different nations and the German officers sitting there as well and a couple of unusual enlightened Germans there who were helping some of these prisoners escape or go back, including Messiaen himself. So a remarkable story, and there's a wonderful little book actually called For the End of Time by Rebecca Rishon, which tells the story of this piece.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's leap just about a decade ahead and something entirely different. Here's Karlheinz Stockhausen. Okay, we're out of Serenity, and we're into something that we recognize as very much the second half of the 20th century, but
right.
What is going on here? What's the ambition here?
Yeah, well, after 1945, things do get quite strange, and you have yet another revolutionary new generation of composers coming forward, and some of these young men mostly had witnessed terrible things and experienced terrible things fighting as teenagers in the last years and months of the war, including Stockhausen himself, who served as a medical orderly, who described some just extraordinarily ghastly scenes that he witnessed when he was still basically a child. So these composers just absolutely, completely wanted to reject the past. There's still some kind of residue of romanticism behind Schoenberg's music, some kind of longing, some kind of, of Viennese feeling there. This music just cuts itself off completely from the past, from the familiar, and leaps into this new electronic world. And composers were making use of these new tape machines, which had been invented by the Germans during the war, perfected by the Germans, magnetic tape machines, creating collages of sounds taped outside the studio. Or Stockhausen was among the first to really attempt to synthesize musical sound in the studio. And from this strange music comes actually the technique behind nearly all of modern pop music.
Let's hear a little bit of John Cage. He takes it even further. Here's Williams' mix, 52-53. Okay, we are deep in the 20th century now. Yeah. Roll over Beethoven.
Yeah, I mean, that piece was actually created, it only lasts a few minutes, and it took month after month after month to create because Cage and his associates were sitting around cutting up these tiny pieces of tape and splicing them together, and, actually, it would take just a few minutes to create such a piece today just by gathering a lot of digital samples on a laptop. I like that little jazzy moment there. I'd love you heard it.
Right.
But it took a long, long time to do this kind of thing back then. But again, a technique that was picked up by pop musicians a few years later.
And people were listening. When Stockhausen did his thing, I don't know, maybe Cage as well, in another decade and change, you could hear it moving on into popular music. We'll get just a little of that in just a second here. Alex Ross is with us. His new book is The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. It's really a history of the century told through music. It goes on into music, but pulls in all the political and cultural history at the same time. It's really a wonderful read. You can join us when you know the history. Does the music open up to you in a new way? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Paul McCartney was a Stockhausen fan. Well, it's not hard to hear it here. As the Beatles began to unroll, here's the White Album, Revolution 9. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the 20th century's classical music, from Stravinsky and Mahler to Copland and Cage. And behind me, right here, Steve Reich, 1974-76, Music for 18 Musicians, Section 3A, right here. My guest is Alex Ross, music critic for The New Yorker magazine, author of the new book, The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. He presents it as really a history of the century, told through music, the history behind the music, the history in the music. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Will they listen to 20th century classical in 200 years' time as we listen to Mozart today? And what's the musical message you're hearing now from the 20th century? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Alex Ross, from the sort of chirps and burps of Cage, we're into a new, more familiar, if at the same time very different. What's the history moving music out of Messiaen and then into, let's say, Cage, now on here to this almost Philip Glass kind of sound with Reich?
Yeah, well, this is another new generation, American composers. They came of age in the 50s and 60s. They grew up with American pop music and just the whole fabric of 50s America and, you know, driving your car across the country and stopping to eat a Big Mac and this whole post-war American culture that had nothing to do with this Central European expressionism and the feeling of Paris in the 20s. So they wanted to have their own new language. And Riley, Reich, and Glass incorporated aspects of the music they were listening to, especially modern jazz, Miles Davis and Coltrane, and the idea of music that slowly builds over a drone or repeating pattern. And that was very big in jazz in the late 50s and into the 60s. And they're also listening to early rock and roll. So that informs this amazing new music, which is tonal, but not in the Mozart or Brahms sense at all. It's a modern American tonality. It's glistening, it's gleaming, it moves along at fast speed. It gives the sense of a car going down an endless two-lane highway somewhere out in the West. And Reich, in fact, came up with the original ideas that led to minimalism while living in the Bay Area and studying it in Mills College. And Terry Riley came up with In C, the classic minimalist piece, in San Francisco in 1964. So this was a California West Coast phenomenon.
If there's the musical environment here of Coltrane and Miles Davis, maybe some bebop, and the physical world, the chrome-plated sheen of that era's America, as you describe it, what about a philosophical or spiritual reference here? Is there a California culture in that respect, in this music, or what follows it?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I'm an Easterner. It's dangerous to generalize about California. But there is a sense of definitely rejecting a lot of European values about sort of a very clear, strict form. Here's your first theme. Here's your second theme. Let's develop it. Instead, music as landscape, music as space opening up, and getting into a dreaming state of mind. And there's no accident that a lot of this music was invented in conjunction with the psychedelic 60s, and there was a lot of overlap. One of Reich's fellow students at Mills College was Phil Lesh, who went on to move from very, very complex avant-garde composition to being in the Grateful Dead. So, you know, overlapping stories and a lot of really interesting trading back and forth of ideas.
David Bowie influenced by Reich, you point out, The Velvet Underground.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, well, Bowie and Eno saw concerts by Reich and Glass in the early 70s and were very influenced by them. And the Velvet Underground simply grew out of the improvising ensemble of Lamont Young, who's another really inventive composer of this period. Not a minimalist exactly, but, you know, someone who really worked on music developed out of drones and these sort of evening-long rituals. And the Velvet Underground, several members came straight out of his ensemble.
Let's take a call from Stephen in West Roxbury, Massachusetts. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen. Great program. I just wanted to make sure that no one just totally thought that the 20th century composers were the tonal bad guys. There's lots of non-tonal music experimented through chromaticism. I'm thinking of Gesualdo in the 16th, 17th century, even Beethoven's Große Fugue. Copland even experimented with atonal music, 12-tone music. Two other quick points, and then I'll just take comments off the air. Mm. The second Viennese school just seemed to have such a contempt for the audience. They were writing for one another, or for the academics, and it was basically digging a hole into which the audience wouldn't jump. Mm. And then finally, I love the new crop of composers who are out there because they really have the audience in mind without selling them short.
Name those. Name who you love there, Stephen.
Aaron J. Kernis, Peter Torkey, that crowd.
Mm, mm.
Yeah, Michael Torkey, John
Michael
Adams.
Torkey, Michael Torkey. Yeah. Peter Torkey's the monkey.
Yeah.
Holy mackerel. But thanks so much. A great program.
Thanks so much.
Thank
Stephen, what do you say? In particular, on this point of composers sort of shutting the clubhouse door, wanting to go where the audience would not follow, almost.
Well, that's a just accusation in some cases, particularly in the post-war era. You had composers creating music in a kind of laboratory atmosphere, and it seemed to be principally of interest to their fellow composers in a small circle of connoisseurs. And things did get a little extreme and sometimes pretty absurd there in Europe, especially in the 1950s and 1960s. But then Schoenberg, I mean, people bash Schoenberg, and you know, I always have to come back to the point that he actually didn't have contempt for his audience. He heard these sounds in his head. He felt he had no choice but to write them down. And he actually desperately wanted people to understand them. And it was just that he was just very idealistic, and he had this utopian idea that somehow someday everyone would wake up and love this music. But I think it's unjust to accuse him of contempt. And there's a wonderful story. You know, he ended up in California in his later years, having fled Nazi Germany, and one day he was driving with his son up and down the Pacific Coast Highway, and they stopped at an orange juice stand to get some orange juice, and it was a Sunday afternoon, and the New York Philharmonic broadcast was on, and there was a little speaker playing the music, and it was Verklärte Nacht, Transfigured Night by Arnold Schoenberg, one of his much more approachable early pieces,
yes.
Not atonal or 12-tone, but Schoenberg was so delighted, he was
image.
Almost crying to hear,
it's
there playing my music, and so he longed to communicate. And I think audiences, to some extent, are slowly coming around. And Moses and Aaron, which our caller mentioned earlier, packs quite a punch in the opera house when you confront it and see the scene of the orgy around the golden calf and the wild music that Schoenberg wrote to accompany that scene. It's pretty powerful stuff. So, you know, again, if you get into the right frame of mind and there's the right dramatic context for this music, it suddenly makes a lot more sense.
Let's take a call from Paulette in Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Paulette. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well.
Oh, it's great to be on the air. I actually think that it's quite interesting, kind of sad that these composers, the 20th century composers, weren't understood. It just seemed that they were doing much experimenting with sound and that their audiences really had a difficult time sort of staying with them through that, and I've often felt, I've taken many music courses, and I've often felt, you know, listening to 18th and 19th century, it's much less interesting to someone that has somewhat of a trained ear than to listen to this new music, relatively new 20th century music, where they're doing a lot of experimentation, and I've often just felt so bad for lots of the 20th century composers that they were kind of never appreciated, or certainly not as much as 18th and 19th century composers.
Yeah, Paulette, thanks for that. Alex, it leaves me wondering, you know, where you see in this century composers pushing theoretical boundaries in the weight of where the music went, as set against
the actual bloody, disturbing history of the century pushing composers off in these dissonant directions.
Yeah, well, there is a give and take there. And mm-hmm. as I mentioned, to think about what these young people experienced during World War II, it does become more understandable that they would have reached for these extreme sounds. And, in terms of the audience trying to make sense of this music, I think it does pay to have a little patience and to try to read up on it and see where they were coming from, because they have definitely put themselves in a situation where they have drawn criticism onto themselves because of some of their more extreme ideas. But there are serious issues being addressed here, and they have great artistic ambitions. Mm-hmm. And of course, in the past, music often caused misunderstanding when it was first played, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of bafflement when Beethoven presented his late string quartets, and people mm-hmm. thought that he'd lost his mind, and this was just crazy random music. And over time, those works have been accepted. So slowly, we may see some of these pieces moving into the repertory. And already, the Shostakovich symphonies are played all the time,
sure.
by orchestras. They've become mm-hmm. essential. The Quartet for the End of Time, Copland's pieces. I mean, there is a lot of 20th century music which has become entirely accepted and has achieved real popularity.
Let's take a call from Spokane, Washington. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi. Nice to talk with you today, Tom.
Wonderful to have you.
The point I'd like to make is this. Coming up through the conservatory system, there's a genuflection to Mozart and Beethoven and the great so-called classics that when I had the good fortune of traveling in India and met with Indian musicians, they thought the idea of music that was 200 and 300 years old to be rather current, considering the...
you call that classical? Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, those ragas in their culture had been around for a couple thousands of years, and so it seems...
Oh, yeah.
It seems almost as if there's... It seems somewhat arbitrary to assign that label.
Yeah, it's a great point. How about time and classification here? I mean, 20th century is just the day before yesterday. Do you struggle with that word, classical, applied here, or is it a natural, obvious one for you, Alex?
Well, actually, I have problems in general with the phrase classical music because for so many people, it does conjure up an idea of music that began somewhere around 1700, 1800, and ended in 1900, and that's absolutely not the case. And we do have this vital musical tradition going up to the present day. So in the Western world, it is problematic. And then when you go elsewhere, when you talk about Indian classical music and Persian classical music, you have these very different traditions and this great sense of the very ancient music coming straight up into the present and still being developed and people improvising wildly over these very, very old rules of music making. And, perhaps something we should... That's something we should aspire to more in the West, a really healthy fusion of past and present. And actually, Yo-Yo Ma, with his Silk Road project, mm-hmm. has undertaken this really wonderful mission to go all over the world and to look at the different kinds of classical musics and see what combinations can arise.
We started in 1906 at the beginning of a century. Let's push right to the end and even a little bit behind. Here's Osvaldo Golijov, 2004, Airy 3. We'll listen. Just beyond the 20th century. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Alex Ross, where have we gone here with the wonderful Golijov?
Yeah, well, things are really interesting right now in music because all of these different streams that the 20th century composers invented and launched are now just all moving side by side, and you have some composers continuing to write the very thorny music on the one hand, and then minimalism is still playing itself out, and composers using relatively simple chords and developing them and maybe fusing them with pop music and all kinds of other influences. And Galiaf is sort of taken a little bit from everything, and in the cycle Aire, which conjures up the musical world of Moorish Spain and all of these cultures interacting, he's produced a classical piece which sounds like a pop album, and it's produced like a pop album, but it is a serious musical composition and is very carefully plotted out. And he's persuaded the operatic soprano Dawn Upshaw to sing in this extraordinary new way, which you couldn't possibly recognize her from her Mozart recordings, and worked out the music with his band, with his group of musicians. So it's redefining the composer as someone who's out there in the culture, not just sitting in his studio and dreaming up sounds, but just really interacting with music and life as it's lived now.
And we mentioned here at the top, let's go from Moorish Spain to Iceland practically right now. Here's Björk, 2001 Vespertine. Alex, we don't know how to classify Björk, but she's clearly pulling on so many of the strands that you've painted for us here today.
Yeah, well, here's a pop music piece, which begins very much like a 20th century classical composition. This thick harmony, wordless chorus, this dense cluster of notes, but then her voice comes in, and, oh, no, it's Björk, and it turns into an unconventional pop song, but recognizable as one nonetheless. There on the other side, you have a lot of pop musicians these days who aren't writing straight ahead commercial stuff. They're taking influences from many places, including the violent and fascinating 20th century in classical music. And of course, this goes back to the Beatles and that great moment when McCartney and Lennon were listening to these crazy Cage and Stockhausen pieces and seeing what they could learn from them. So sometimes it gets quite difficult to tell the difference between, well, what is a classical piece nowadays and what's a pop piece. And obviously the distinctions are still pretty obvious, but out on certain borders we're entering a new age where maybe we can't tell the difference anymore.
Alex Ross, it's been a rocket ride through a century. You're a great pilot, and it's been such a pleasure and privilege. The new book is The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. We'll go out with John Adams, 1985, Harmonilar. Alex, thank you so much. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. This was great fun.
You can hear and read more at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.